You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Let's find out what's in store for our weather today. Here with a report, we have Cedric Haynes of the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back as we make our way through your Friday and into the weekend. And boy, do we have a weather situation today. We've got a fire weather warning in effect for us across the Wasatch Back as temperatures climb into the 80s across the Park City area, highs around 90 in the Heber Valley. We'll see some areas of blowing dust potentially as well with that sunshine. Otherwise, again, with the dry conditions and the windy conditions, we are going to see that potential of any rapid fire spreads taking place across the area. So again, a fire weather warning in effect through not just for today, but into your Saturday as well. Saturday will feature an increase in cloud cover and a slight chance of a little moisture, especially by the afternoon evening hours. We will have a good chance of seeing some isolated showers moving through as a strong cold front moves our way. High temperatures on your Saturday in Park City will only climb into the low 70s. We'll only be around 80 for your high temperature as we get you over towards the Heber Valley on your Saturday afternoon. By the time we go into your Sunday, we'll keep a chance of a few scattered isolated showers out there across the region. Nothing too widespread or all day, but there'll be a couple of passing showers. The bigger story, no doubt about it, will be the big chill that returns as we head into your Sunday. High temperatures in Park City will struggle to reach the 60-degree mark by the afternoon hours. It's going to be a chilly day for us in Park City. Meanwhile, in the Heber Valley, we're looking at high temperatures only in the mid to upper 60s. So, yes, definitely way below average by some 10 to 20 degrees out there. Get this, as we head into your Sunday night, we'll clear the skies out, and that's going to allow temperatures to plummet. And by the time you wake up Monday morning as you're heading back off to work, get ready. You're going to be waking up, heading out the door to temperatures down into the low to mid 30s across the area. Can't even rule out some patchy frost developing as we head into your Monday morning. Now, Monday afternoon, we'll start to rebound a little bit with highs back into the mid to upper 60s in Park City. Highs will climb back into the mid 70s in the Heber Valley, and we'll warm back up into the 70s and 80s as we head throughout most of next week with lots of sunshine with more high pressure. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Darren Van Cleve of the National Weather Service. Then Ed Parisian will stop by with a debrief from last night's Park City Council meeting. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Adam Loomis of Park City Ski and Snowboarding. Now let's do a little bit of local news. Connor Thomas has a report on an update on the results of the Democratic primary here in Summit County.
The Democratic primary is likely to decide the races for Summit County Council in Districts 4 and 5, with no Republicans in the running. No write-ins have announced either. Unofficial results from the Summit County Clerk's Office show Christy Babalis in the lead in the District 4 Democratic primary and Candace Hart slightly ahead in District 5. It's the first Summit County Council election with five separate districts. That has meant fewer votes cast and slimmer margins for the eventual victors. Voter turnout in Summit County's Democratic primaries was about 43%. Babalis, an attorney and political newcomer, faced off against former Planning Commissioner John Kuchera to represent the Central Snyderville Basin. The unofficial results as of June 24th show she garnered 427 votes to Kuchera's 378. In the Jeremy Ranch area, the incumbent Hart led Park City School Board member Meredith Reed by 14 votes, 357 to 343. Also, as of June 24th, the Summit County Clerk's Office had received 183 ballots that it couldn't count. That could be because voter signatures didn't match what the clerks had on file. It could also be because a voter left off or incorrectly wrote the last four digits of their social security number or driver's license on their ballot. The clerk's office will notify those voters by mail and explain how to verify their ballot so it can be counted. The deadline to do so is noon on July 6th before Summit County makes tallies official July 7th. It's unclear whether the outstanding ballots are located in Summit County Council Districts 4 or 5, or whether they are for Republican or Democratic primaries. It's also unclear how many of the 183 will eventually be counted. That leaves the council races too close to call until July 7th. The general election is November 3rd. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, we usually think of the National Weather Service when it comes to predicting powder days, something that happened all too rarely this year. But the effects of that lack of snowpack have rolled into the summer season. Here to talk about fires and their impact on the weather system, and more importantly, the impact of the weather system on fires, we have Darren Van Cleve of the National Weather Service. Good morning, Darren. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
So, Darren, let's start with the big picture. As I said, we all often think of the National Weather Service as predicting rain or snow. Tell us a little bit about your role is with respect to monitoring fire risk levels.
Sure. So our role related to fire it helps to think of what in wildland fire they call the fire triangle, the three things that really add to wildfire risk. One is the three factors, I should say, that really add to wildfire risk. One is weather, one is topography, and one is fuels. So our specialty, as you can imagine, is in the side of weather, specifically what kind of weather lends itself to fire spread. And it's the things you would intuitively think of: hot, dry, windy, with the emphasis on dry and windy. The way that fuels respond to fire changes significantly when they're dry, and fire spreads in much different ways when the wind is elevated. So our role in the National Weather Service is forecasting those conditions that are conducive to wildfire spread, and then we work with many other agencies that are related to wildfire management, and we inform them in advance of conditions, those kind of conditions that are conducive. We do special forecasts really year round for folks in that area, and then coming into wildfire season, obviously we're doing more. And then the things that you would see from a public facing side, red flag warnings are the warnings that we issue when conditions are especially ripe for fire spread. Initially, those were kind of more for those in that wildland fire management side, but they are a public-facing warning. And increasingly over the years, they've become also something where the public can know, hey, this is a time when I should be especially careful.
So let's go back. It's interesting. You laid out three factors. I guess intuitively, I would have thought that heat was the most important, that a high temperature was. But what you're saying is really it's more humidity and wind that are the more significant of the three.
Right. And I mean, obviously, if you think of an instance in the cool season when the temperature isn't as hot, probably intuitively there's less risk. Although I will point out that in recent years, wildfires have happened even in what you would traditionally think of as winter months. Several years ago on the Front Range of Colorado, on the other side of the Rockies, there was this significant wildfire event in the Boulder area that burned a number of homes. It happened in the months of November into December. You wouldn't really think of that. However, their fuels were quite dry, so their temperatures in those cases weren't hot, but by any means. But yeah, it's really the humidity and the winds, because fuels, which is just anything that's out there to burn, usually the vegetation, that responds. The way it burns varies drastically depending on how much moisture it has.
And, you know, we normally think of us as Utah, and the Wasatch Back in particular, as a relatively dry area all the time. So what kind of levels of humidity really spark, for lack of a better term, a high fire risk danger?
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, here in Utah for red flag warnings, and we use a criteria that has a relative humidity of 15% or less. And it's not that there's anything necessarily magic about that threshold. That's just that in combination of certain wind gusts, usually wind gusts of 35 miles per hour in valleys and desert areas where it's commonly more windy, and 25 miles per hour up in the mountains where it isn't quite as common to be that windy. The combination of those two things. Around the Weather Service, you'll find that red flag warning criteria varies, and it just varies based on the climatology of that area. So for Utah, in the mountains in Utah, such as the Wasatch Back and those other mountain valleys, we found that a relative humidity of 15% or less, and in concert with wind gusts of 25 or higher, tend to be those thresholds that help delineate days of higher fire weather risk.
You know, you made a couple of references to red flag warnings. Can we take a step back and just talk about sort of the levels of fire risk that you use? What are the sort of labels that you put on them, and what do they mean?
Sure. Well, we have, in terms of what the average person would see on our website, probably about the only two fire weather related things that you'll see on there is we can issue a fire weather watch. And that's issued usually several days in advance when we see conditions where there's somewhere in the neighborhood of a 50% probability of those kind of dry and windy conditions that I mentioned earlier. Then as the event gets closer in time and our confidence in it increases, generally like more of an 80% probability of it happening, that's when we would upgrade to a warning. Those are the main public facing types of fire weather criteria or fire weather alerts that your listeners would see. We do with the fire mitigation partners that we work with, we do use a scale of what we call a weather risk outlook, and you also see that show up in graphics that we put on our website. And we use that same scale, whether it's fire weather, whether it's winter storms, whether it's wind, any kind of weather hazard, we use this same scale just to try to treat everything consistently. On that, we have a 5-level scale that goes from little to no threat on one side to an extreme threat on the other side.
And where are we now in terms of fire risk levels?
Sure. So for the Wasatch Back in particular, this would be a moderate event. And now what you'll see on our website right now, not to step too much away from those listeners there in the Wasatch Back, but I would point out right now in Southwest Utah, we do have an extreme risk level, and that's because of the very large Cottonwood fire that's happening there. So the red flag warning that's in effect right now for the Wasatch Back, the winds that we have forecasted in that area are not of the same magnitude of what we have forecast in Southwest Utah. So I just wanted to draw that clarification, because if somebody hopped on our website, they might mistakenly think that the entire state was under that same risk. And there's certainly a risk in the Wasatch Back right now, which is why we do have that red flag warning out there that I mentioned. But the greatest risk looking across the area that we service, which is the majority of the state, is actually down in Southwest Utah.
And that area with the extreme danger, how large an area is that, and how many fires are burning there now?
Yeah, well, the fire I can speak to most confidently, and the one that your listeners will no doubt have heard of, is the Cottonwood fire burning east of Beaver. That fire has spread at just alarmingly fast rates over the last few days. I would point out too that fire even started on a day that the kind of criteria I was talking about earlier, wind speed and relative humidity, was not even reaching the threshold of what we would issue a red flag warning for. It was a little bit shy. And the fact that it spread that much on a day that conditions were not as conducive to it, that is why we are so concerned with what's going to be happening this afternoon. This afternoon is going to be much windier, much drier. Obviously, we have crews out on that fire that we didn't have initially. In fact, there is a Weather Service meteorologist that is embedded on site at that fire, giving crews, minute by minute weather updates. We call that position an incident meteorologist. Currently in the state of Utah, two fires are large enough to have incident meteorologists on them. One is that Cottonwood fire. The other is the Iron fire that you also might have heard of. It's burning in the Juab County area. That caused an evacuation recently of the town of Eureka.
You know, that's really interesting, this the vision of having a meteorologist sort of embedded with a firefighting crew. It kind of reminds me of that new movie that talks about the importance of meteorologists on D-Day. Once again, sort of the idea that weather is really an important element of different kinds of fights. What will that actually embedded meteorologist do? Will they actually be with the crews, and are they running tests? How does that actually work?
Sure. So I myself am not an incident meteorologist, but speaking from what I know of the staff that we have, so we have two of our meteorologists here at the weather forecast office in Salt Lake City that have gone through a lot of extra training, including practice deployments to fires, to the level of where we as an agency are comfortable saying that yes, we can send them out to a fire when they're on site, in terms of what kind of things they're doing. That crew that's following the incident command structure, as it's called, there at the fire, has a number of briefings that happen throughout the day. They're planning their tactics, they're planning their strategies for how they're going to fight the fire. And much of that involves, like as we talked about earlier, with the fire triangle and weather being a huge part of it, many of the decisions they're making are, they need to know what kind of conditions to expect on the fire. Is it going to, you know, hot, whatever, how dry it's going to be, how windy it's going to be, potentially being hot too, if there's going to be thunderstorms in the area with gusty outflow winds, is there going to be lightning, or are there going to be maybe new starts? These are all things. How much is the relative humidity going to recover, as we would say, overnight? And whether that will cause the fire to die down and be less active overnight. Anyways, those are just a sample of the many decisions that those individuals fighting that fire are making, and how weather is intimately connected to all of those. So the incident meteorologist, or IMET, is there providing briefings. They usually have a giant poster on the wall with a big matrix of for this day, for this operational period of our firefight, we're expecting, you know, relative humidities of this and this. And they're speaking to that. Per my understanding, they're given those kind of briefings constantly throughout the day. They work very long days, by the way. And I can tell you that they're usually starting 5 o'clock in the morning ish and going until, I don't know, 8 p.m., 9 p.m., barely enough time to sleep, getting up, doing the same thing the next day. Depending on the nature of the incident, these incident meteorologists that the Weather Service is sending out to the fires might be sleeping in tents. I mean, they're sleeping in whatever the same conditions are that the firefighters have there. And that's just to say that our folks in the Weather Service are willing to get out there and get our hands dirty. We're not just going to be sitting in here, you know, in an air-conditioned building, just typing up these products and sending them out to the ether. Like, what our agency really wants to be hand-in-hand with other entities that are making decisions based on weather and informing them and arming them with weather information.
And I guess you mentioned this, but I'm just thinking that things like predicting which way the wind is going to blow is pretty crucial in terms of evaluating, you know, what firefighting techniques, where do you try to draw fire lines, those
absolutely.
Kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, here in the Western U.S., where generally most fires are going to be in areas of complex terrain, as you can imagine, all the mountains, valleys, canyons, all of those terrain features heavily modify winds. So one of the things that our incident meteorologists are doing, I didn't mention this earlier, they can help set up temporary weather stations in certain key points around the the fire. Those things are called ROS. They'll set up these mobile ROS stations around the fire that help them in ways like ordinarily we might not know or be particularly concerned with what happens in an obscure canyon in a mountain range. But when there's a fire in that vicinity, suddenly when the winds normally get going during the day, when they turn around and blow down canyon overnight, all those fine scale details suddenly are a huge deal.
Okay.
One other thing I didn't mention real quick, our incident meteorologists also can launch weather balloons on site at the fire.
Hmm. Okay. Anyone who's been here this winter and spring knows it's been a very dry year. What would you expect to see during the remainder of this year's fire season, given this historically dry season we've had so far? See any change in that going forward, and what should we expect in terms of a fire season?
Sure. So those official forecasts come from the Great Basin Area Coordination Center, and I can speak to what they've been forecasting, which is exactly what we're seeing now, elevated above normal fire weather risk starting in the month of June, and we're seeing that now. They're forecasting that through next month as well. One thing that all of us meteorologists are watching very closely is whether we're going to be able to get any surge of moisture from the southwest monsoon here in Utah. We just call it the monsoon. All of the last few months, our weather forecast models that extend far out in time have been showing a better than a coin flip chance of getting a stronger monsoon this year. The trick is, when is it going to finally get started, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as that gets started, we have, on the fringes of the surge of moisture, you might have thunderstorms that are drier, but once really the core of the moisture moves in, then you've got a good chance of wetting rains. That's the kind of stuff that we would like to see, and it happens, consistently every single day. We did get some storms obviously yesterday, but that was just a tiny taste because it's getting very dry again this afternoon, and we don't have a true surge where it's going to last for multiple days yet. Anyways, the latest projections that I've seen are still showing that better than a coin flip chance of seeing a stronger than normal monsoon, but they're pushing the onset of it farther back in time. So think more towards the middle of next month, which gives us about 2 to 3 more weeks of the kind of conditions that we've had here, where we might get a just a quick tease of it that will pass a day, but then we're right back to a dry. We at our office are certainly hoping for that to happen soon. We would love for it to extend all the way up here to northern Utah. There's many years where it tends to hang out in southern Utah. We're sort of on the fringe. Obviously, southern Utah really needs the help. We just spoke about the extreme Cottonwood fire happening now. They've got the worst end of the conditions that I mentioned earlier. So, yes, we're looking at that being towards the middle of this next month.
All right, Darren Van Cleve of the National Weather Service, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Absolutely.
Wildfires have burned more than 140,000 acres across Utah so far this year. More than 75% of those fires have been caused by humans. Governor Spencer Cox declared a state of emergency Thursday afternoon, calling on Utahns to take extra care as the 4th of July holiday nears. Because conditions are so dry and crews are already deployed to fires across the state, Cox says the holiday weekend has life or death stakes.
If on July 3rd, 4th, or 5th, we have multiple starts in this valley, we're screwed. Okay? That's it. Nobody to respond.
He signed an executive order temporarily giving State Forester Jamie Barnes more power to prohibit fireworks. Typically, the forester can only ban fireworks on state and unincorporated lands. For now, she can extend the ban to cities, too. If cities want to designate safer areas where people can celebrate under supervision, they must work with fire officials to do so.
Our goal is simple, to make sure our communities are still standing on July 5th.
The statewide default will be no fireworks allowed. Utah will also elevate fire restrictions to Stage 2 Friday. They prohibit open fires of any kind, including campfires and pits, fireworks, and more. Details about the restrictions are available at kpcw.org. Cox says firefighters are seeing unprecedented fire behavior this summer.
As I've seen these fire officials who aren't scared of anything, I've seen real fear for the first time in my time working with them. When people have dedicated their lives to protecting Utah tell us this year is different, we desperately need to listen.
Park City has already banned fireworks. Locals can celebrate Independence Day with a drone show at Park City Mountain. In Wasatch County, Midway has canceled its fireworks show. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Council had a regular meeting last night. Here with a debrief is Councilmember Ed Prision. Morning, Ed.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
You betcha.
So, we've got a few things to talk about. Let's start with there was a work session, I think, yesterday afternoon about a pathway for Three Kings.
Yep.
Tell us about, first of all, tell us what that's all about. What is that?
Well, it came about as the active transportation network that we're trying to get, you know, walkability, so you can walk anywhere around town safely. So we did the Thames one last year between Three Kings and 224, you know, the one by the golf course there. So this is kind of a continuation of that, but we didn't want to do a 12-footer there. It doesn't fit. It's not the right spot for it. So we came to do talking about a 6-foot pathway on the east side. So it'll be the golf course, side from basically the resort to Thames. And it would hook in to Thames and then down to the lights. And then you could walk the Dans and whatnot.
So part of it would basically run for all the way from 224 parallel to the driving range. It's go all the way that,
well,
down
Thames.
Right.
We got the one that's on Thames already.
Right.
And then you're going to hook a left onto Three Kings.
Onto Three Kings.
And then on your left, it would be all the way, you know, by Payday Condos and Three Kings Condos. And so there'll be a path.
Would that require there. Widening of the road? Or?
No, because we're going to try to, I might even call, do some shrinking of the road a little bit.
Okay.
So there's plenty of right-of-way there.
Okay.
So we'll do the 6-foot walking path, and then there'll be bike path in the road itself.
Okay. So there'll be separate walking and biking, yeah. Which is always a good thing, I suppose.
I think so, too, right.
And is there a lot of pedestrian traffic over there? I mean,
Tons, from what the locals are saying. When I go there, I don't see a whole lot. But in the winter,
it
gets a little sketchy to walk on the streets. So.
And I guess there's people walking from the various residences there over to the resort.
Yep.
And in the winter, I guess there's a safety issue that you
walk to Silver Star.
Mm-hmm.
If the lift is open.
If we get enough snow for the lift, right. Let's hope that's an issue next year,
right,
that the lift is open, right? Okay, so did that get finally approved last night? Where does it stand?
We said, there was some concepts presented, but basically the staff was saying, you know, this is probably the best, and we're like, yeah, we agree. We didn't want to put the full 12 there, and I don't think we want e-bikes and baby carriages and walkers and people all together. So,
from here,
I found out that from little Kate, they don't want that one. I'm like, I don't blame you.
Yeah. So to move forward from here, staff eventually we'll come back for a final decision.
Yep.
Okay.
They'll do some design work and get the exact.
I know, speaking of final decisions, I understand a couple items came up for final approval. One was the budget. And I just want to ask, how did you feel about the budget process this year? Did they give you guys enough visibility? Did you feel good about being able to make a good decision?
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of this stuff is fixed, right? I mean, most of these budget items are pretty fixed year over year, salaries and electric and whatever the expenses are. You know, they're kind of... So basically what we touch on each year are the one-offs. You know, what kind of capital and what kind of projects we're working on there. So the day-to-day stuff is kind of rote, you know. So pretty much when we get in, we just touch on the big stuff and the little stuff we know we can't do anything about anyway. So, you know, yeah.
You had what you needed. You needed.
Right. Okay. We get what we need. We had a couple people talk about the budget public comment this year, so that's nice. Nan should be happy about that, because we don't usually get those, but we got a couple.
Okay.
But it's good. It's all passed. It's good.
An issue that's received a lot of public comment, however, was the proposed salary increase. And my understanding is that came up again last night. My understanding was that when it came up the last time, the sort of revised salary proposal, right, that you were in favor of it, but last night you voted against it. What, right, if I got that right, and what changed your mind?
Well, at the initial discussion, I had asked, is there any way in between? Mm-hmm. Because they came out with this big number, which I had never been asked about.
That was the very first number. That was the the 50% increase or some number like that.
100%.
100% increase, yeah.
And no one ever asked us. So all of a sudden, it's like on the agenda. I'm like, wait a minute, what is this? So I thought we could use a raise, and I brought up during the meeting, like, isn't there somewhere in between here? And crickets, nobody said anything. So I'm like, all right. So kind of in a moment of weakness, I voted yes, but I really didn't think I wanted that kind of raise, and I didn't want that.
And that was for the compromise raise. That was for the lower number.
That I voted no on, because then I started doing some math. And right. I'm like, all right, what if cost of living from 2014, so it'll give you a number, and it came out to about 31 and change. I thought that was fair. I mean, okay. I know what I signed up for, the deal. So I didn't feel comfortable getting the raise. So I'm like, well, if I don't feel comfortable getting the raise, I might as well vote no on just a little bit of raise, because it still was over the number that I thought I was signing up for. So luckily, I got a chance to vote no on it.
Had you voted yes on the previous iteration of this sort of modified raise, or have I got that wrong?
Did I vote yes?
Yes.
No, I voted no.
You voted no every time?
Both times.
Okay,
yeah.
You have voted no.
So I voted yes on the first one, and thinking about it, I'm like, I shouldn't have done that. So
you did vote yes on the first one?
On the very first one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, big one.
Yeah.
All right, now I've caught up. Ed, how did this issue first come in front of the council? Do you understand how it got here? Because the first time I heard of it, I was talking to Diego on one of these meetings, and he said it showed up on a budget line, and I asked him, and he says, I don't know. And do you know how it came into being?
Apparently, it was on a budget line. I didn't see it. It was on a back page somewhere. I didn't even notice it until the staff report came out before the meeting that we were going to vote for it. And I'm like, as soon as I saw it, I called the city manager. I'm like, what is this? And he didn't know, because he had just started. Adam had just started on the job. And so it kind of like came with him. So I don't know. I don't know where it came from.
Okay.
I do, but I don't know.
Maybe
I have guesses.
I'm not asking for guesses. So Ed, so now we had a 3-2 vote. I take it the other no was Bill Scirocco.
Yep.
And okay, is that the end of it? Has it now been passed?
Yep.
Okay, moving on.
Yep, moving on. It's not a big raise. It's just a little bit over what I calculated if you did the cost of living stuff. So I'm like, fine with it. But we're going to have another big discussion in the fall. And I want to get it all out. I want to know, do people want me to be part-time or full-time? Because that was a big thing. You're only part-time, yet we do a lot of work. We're on duty, I swear, 24/7. It takes over your head. So we're going to have the discussion. Is this a full-time job? Is this a part-time job? What's it worth? Do some more comps. You know, there's this thing called reverse ratcheting. And it was a Stanford Law paper about it. And comps, because it's a concept that everything's based on comps. But if everything's based on comps and the comps never go up because they're based on the comps, then nothing ever goes up. And that was one of the theories. And this was a Stanford Law review about why city councilor pay doesn't go up, because it's always based on the comps, which never go up, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it never changes, because same as you saw here, all the discussions about what people made at Jackson or Aspen. And if you use those comps and you never adjust them, then everything stays low. So we're going to have a discussion about who's going to be the first one to break this mold, right? And I think that was the idea of Park City. It's like, let's set the precedent so that the comps go up, that other comps can follow the comps, if you know what I mean.
You referred to something that's really interesting, which is, what is the model for what the Park City Council is going to be? Is it a part-time job? Is it an almost full-time job? What are, you know, is the model that the council should rely primarily on staff and basically only basically do decision-making and executive level, how much into the weeds are you supposed to get? And I think those models vary from town to town across the country. And where are we going to end up?
This is the discussion I want to have in the fall. And we're going to. We all agree. We're going to have this discussion because I want to know myself. Mm-hmm. So do you want, when you send me an email, we get constant emails. I like to respond to everyone. So if I'm full-time, maybe I'll give you a nice long answer. If you want me to be part-time, I'll be like, thank you for your input, period. But I don't think people want that. They want to, you know, feel like their email is the one that I should spend an hour on to respond, which I have spent more than an hour responding to people just to get the facts right because they want 40 different questions answered. So what do you, I want to know what's expected of me. Mm-hmm. You know, do you want me to be full-time? Do you want me to be part-time? Do you want me to stick my nose in everything? Do you want me to go to every ribbon cutting and every open house and every, you know, 2x2 meeting? So I'm curious to see, and I want this to be in full public, and I want public comment. What do you want? And I'll be it. But I want to know.
Are you bringing in some kind of experts to try to help you look at what's going on across the country? When you say it's going to be a discussion, how are you going to structure that, or do you know yet?
Good question. I don't know. It's going to be in the fall, okay. I think. I don't know how we're going to do it. Hopefully, Sarah from HR will help us along. But I really want to have this
pretty open discussion about it.
Full public. I want it all to come out so that once and for all we know what we expect it to do.
Any other highlights you want to touch on? Because I've got some more questions. What else happened last night that was interesting to you?
Let's see. We had a big closed session, so obviously
you can't talk about that
stuff. But that was a big, that was most of the meeting. You know, it was a good 3-hour one.
I know you guys looked at artwork at the bus stops.
Yep.
Did you talk about, what are we doing there, and does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, it was just going by the one at Town Lift, they had one. I'm like, where are they going to put this thing? So, again, like you say, you know, staff drives a lot of things. That was on a consent item. It was part of the process of updating all these bus stops with some nice art. If you see some of the ones out there now, like by the Mark and whatnot, there's some nice art there. It's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. It looks nice. I remember when it came up, I'm like, just make it, like, different. I don't want every bus stop like exactly the same. So with the art, we can make them all a little different. And
I understand there are some pretty cool renderings of what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is that on the city website? Can people see that? Do you know?
The ones that are going to be?
The renderings, yeah. Are those up yet?
I haven't seen them.
Okay. Before we go, there was a discussion of a contract modification at the 516 Marsac Avenue building.
Yeah.
Which, as I understand it, you do construction, things happen. Sometimes it takes more money.
Yeah.
In and of itself, it's not that interesting. But my question for you is, philosophically, what is your thinking in terms of affordable housing going forward on that issue of rental versus ownership of affordable housing? Where's your head on that?
We need both. But everybody that I know that lives in, say, like Woodside or Cook Drive or Park City Heights, it owns, loves it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Snow Creek, they all are so grateful that they have this opportunity to live and own in Park City. And, you know, a lot of our great locals live in these places too, you know, that have done so many good things here. So I think it's awesome. I want to have a little more for sale ones, but I think people have gotten scared a little bit because of some of the HOA issues with some of these properties, that the repair expenses have kind of gone up too much, and now maybe they're not quite as affordable. So we got to fix that. We got to make sure we build something like quality that'll last. But there's a place for rentals. I mean, some people, maybe they just get out of college, they want to be a ski bum for 4 or 5 years, don't really know what to do with life. I want to have a place for them to come hang out and, you know, live the vibe. And if you leave in 5 years, well, fine. At least we got you for 5 years and we got some of your best days and you can come here and hang out in Park City and be a ski bum. I want that vibe available for people.
All right, Ed, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, Raj, life is good, right?
Absolutely. Fourth of July is coming.
Keep believing that, right? I'm going out to Portland tomorrow to see my little nephew fence in the national fencing tournament, so that should be kind of cool.
All right. Ed Parisian, thanks for spending time with us
this morning. Thanks,
Roger. All right.
See ya.
Well, you heard an announcement a little while ago about the annual Springer Tournée. Here to talk about it, the Park City Ski and Snowboard, Ski Jumping and Ski Mountaineering Director, Adam Loomis. Good morning, Adam. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good morning. Happy to be on.
Okay, Adam, I got to start with the name. What is a Springer Tournée? I looked up tournée and it had some kind of French food, so I don't think that's what you're referring to.
No, so Springer Tournée, this is the 27th edition. And I guess the origins are kind of mimicked off one of the premier ski jumping events in Europe called the Vierschanzen Tournée or Four Hills Tournée. So that is obviously four different stops. And Springer Tournée started in the same way, and it was between Calgary and Park City, Utah. So it's always been in Park City for the past decade or so. Calgary has not had their ski jumps open, so it has only been here at Park City.
Oh, Calgary hasn't had their ski jumps open. Is that because of weather, or is it just they've just no longer running the facilities?
Unfortunately, yeah, it was government subsidized, and when the government decided they didn't want to do that, then the jumps went down.
Okay, so you have run this here for the Park City Ski and Snowboard for a number of years. What does the program include?
Yeah, so first and foremost, it's athlete-focused. It's a week long with athletes coming into town to get jumping here on all of our hills, up to our largest hills and down to our smallest hill, starting on Monday, July 6th. And it's a pretty packed schedule with a lot of opportunities for athletes from around the nation and Canada to get training on the hill, to get to know each other with some social events, leading into competitions on all the hills, Nordic combined events as well. We work with Soldier Hollow for those races. And then we finish with this fun event on Saturday evening that we're going to talk a little bit more about, which we've been kind of building up the last couple of years.
So yeah, that's interesting because like if I go to the website, it really talks about the Saturday event, but it's really mm-hmm. a whole week of sort of training and how many athletes will come in and as you say they'll be able to train on all the hills.
Yep. Yeah. So we'll see a little under 100 athletes, a good mix from kids on our smallest, which is like a 10-meter, 20-meter hill. And then, yeah, this year we have basically all of the top junior athletes who are kind of looking to make the step from the club level towards the national team. All those athletes are going to be here. They'll be competing on our 90-meter, our smaller of the Olympic-sized hill, and then on our large hill, our 120.
Now, if I heard you correctly, you also mentioned something about Soldier Hollow. What kind of events can they run during this time of year?
Yeah, so for our older athletes, we'll have Nordic combined racing on roller skis. They have really good roller ski tracks, basically a bike path on Nordic trails that is open for athletes to train on a year-round basis. So they're definitely a year-round facility with, you know, obviously Nordic skiing in the winter, but then in the summertime they have mountain biking and roller skiing. As well as some trails, so our younger athletes will have doing a trail race for the Nordic combined event.
Okay, so when I looked at the website, it talked about something mm-hmm. called the Spin the Wheel Target competition.
Yeah,
and I wondered what could that possibly be.
Yeah, so it's a one of a kind competition where instead of athletes trying to go as far as they can, which is fun, and we have come up with something a little more unique, and it's testing their ability to hit a specific target. So we do have an actual prize wheel, like you'd spin at an expo. And on that, there's a number of distances. Athletes will spin that before they head up to jump, and they'll get a specific distance. So they might come on 110, and then they have to try to jump as close to 110 for one round. And then there's three rounds. So throughout the event, they have a, they're kind of challenged to put down jumps to a specific distance rather than just as far as they can go.
How hard is that to do, and how close do they get?
I have never competed in this event, and I, as a former athlete, would think this would be pretty darn difficult, but when we first brought it in, I was blown away. We've had winners with a total delta of, I think, less than 3 meters between three jumps. So they're basically hitting it on the head.
That is unbelievable. Yep. Especially because this is not something they normally practice. So the So the idea of being able to come down that slide and hit that distance, I guess they're monitoring their speed to try to gauge where they're going to land. Is that how they do it?
Yeah. So the athletes have the freedom to choose their starting position. So say they need to go farther than they're used to, they're going to start way up high, get as much speed as possible, or vice versa. And that plus potentially how they adjust their jump and how they're flying through the air is going to hopefully get them to where they need to be.
Boy, and I have enough trouble hitting a 3-foot putt. Let me ask you this. In terms of the event itself, let's do a little bit of letting people understand what will happen if they come out to the Saturday night event. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're opening up the gates at 5 p.m. on the 11th. And we're going to get going right away with some music playing. We have a kind of Americana folk band, Cory Mond, coming out. We work with Mountain Town Music for that, so we'll have a stage music going right away. And then we'll have athletes starting competing at 6 for 3 rounds of competition. During that time, we're going to have beer sales from Heber Valley Brewing. We'll have a few food trucks. We have Lush's Barbecue bringing up their 2 food trucks, and the Border serving up some Mexican. Just kind of a fun family environment with grass seating as well as the stadium bleachers. And yeah, it's been a fun night to be milling around up at the Utah Olympic Park. And we'll conclude with one more set of music to wrap things up around 8 p.m.
And what kind of music do these guys play?
It's a good mix, but I would say between folk and blues, and like I said, I think Americana is how they identify.
And the food is from Lush's Barbecue. Do they have a food truck?
Lush's and the Border.
And the Border.
Yep.
So it's both.
Yep.
So, Adam, let me ask you this question. Obviously, part of, it sounds like you conduct this event for multiple reasons, but one of which, of course, is fundraising. How important is this in terms of your budget?
Yeah, so events are definitely a good part of our budget. We use them to bring in some extra funds so we can keep our costs for the athletes below what it actually costs to produce the programs. And we're also really fortunate to have support from Summit County Restaurant Tax Grant, and that helps us offset some of our marketing costs to get the word out. And yeah, we use that to bring in a little more that goes directly back towards our youth programs.
And about how many athletes participate in your youth programs throughout the year?
Oh, so PCSS annually is, I think, right around 1,200 athletes in our community, so it's a very significant portion.
Okay. Do they have organized activities all year long for those athletes? What do they do anything in the summer?
Yep. Oh yeah. So obviously we're jumping on plastic on the Nordic jumps, and the pool is open. So we have kids in camps, kids on teams training. We have public drop-ins as well for jumping into the pool. We have the airbag, which is another freestyle and snowboard training grounds, mountain bike programs, and cross country teams are doing dry land year round or throughout the summer. Things are happening. It's just as busy at the Olympic Park this time of year as in the wintertime.
So, Adam, you're ski jumpers, and I take it that's your program. About how many days a week are they practicing?
So our small hills athletes jump 3 days a week on a typical week, and on the bigger hills, 3 to 5. Yep. Most days of the week we have some jumping going on.
Okay. Adam Loomis of Park City Ski and Snowboard. Thanks for spending time with us. Adam, if people want to learn more about the Ski Tournée, where do they go?
Yeah, so you can go to parkcityss.org. You'll see right away under the main page we have events. You can click on the link there, or you can go to Eventbrite and search Springer Tournée. That'll also pull you right towards the ticketing link.
All right. Adam Loomis, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Clark City Planning Commission began its review of the Bonanza Park development plan with a trip to the 5-acre site. Christine Weller has more.
The 7-member Park City Planning Commission, city staff, and developers took a field trip to the 5-acre Bonanza Park site Wednesday. Almost 20 locals joined them, many of whom are vocal opponents of the plans the Park City Council moved forward in March. Holding a microphone and speaker, Stephen Swisher with GTS Development laid out how the site, which borders Kearns Boulevard and Bonanza Drive, could look. Starting in an existing parking lot, he pointed to bright orange cones marking where the 7 proposed buildings will be. Spray-painted lines along Bonanza Drive denoted where a new bus lane will run, and orange streamers tied to trees showed building heights. Commission Chair Kristen Van Dyne welcomed locals to the tour, but reminded them that the commission could not take their feedback. She addressed the recent wave of community pushback during a work session meeting after the site visit. Only the Park City Council has the authority to address what locals don't like, she said.
We are here to process the current application as it's submitted and its compliance with the land management code. We are not the policymakers.
Many of the residents who attended the tour and meeting are part of a loosely organized group called Place PC. The group has publicly voiced its dissatisfaction with plans for the 5 acres and instead advocates for open space. The tour was the commission's first look at Bonanza plans. As proposed, the site would become a mixed-use development with 106 residential units. 88 would be affordable. The ground floor of each building would have commercial facilities, including a restaurant, cafe, and arts spaces. About 2 acres in the center of the site, or 62%, are set aside as open space with a small amphitheater, playground, and lawn space.